of the dangerous path taken by the U.S. trying to push NATO in an aggressive position, threatening Russia. It would be naive, and it was naive, to expect that Russia would not react one moment or the other. So we, in our position, we say there's a huge responsibility by the U.S. government by pushing NATO in an aggressive position against Russia. At the same time, Cuba cannot support and does not support the transgression of the sovereign borders or the sovereignty and territory of any country. That explains our abstention in the resolution that took place in the UN. We also have a great support for some of the resolutions that were quoted in that resolution. We couldn't vote against them. Now, we clearly see that there has been a path, and it's not only with Russia, by the U.S., to act as an aggressive hegemon trying to tear down or to put down any country that it seems that eventually could be a rival to the United States. That is not the way to conduct international relations. It only serves U.S. big corporate interests. It doesn't serve the people of the United States. It doesn't serve the people around the world. And it's a transgression of international law. It's a transgression of peace and of security for all nations.
Your response to the mass protests in Russia right now, as President Putin has declared that he will now send 300,000 more troops to Ukraine?
It's a domestic issue with Russia. We will not respond to that, as you have domestic mass protests in the United States every now and then.
Your response to President Biden now saying that he will soon spend $6.25 million in so-called democracy promotion funding aimed at toppling the Cuban government. You said in any nation this is illegal. Explain.
Well, it is illegal to try to overthrow the government of any country. And spending millions of dollars of U.S. taxpayers' money to try to overthrow a government in Cuba. You can claim it's for democracy, you can claim it's for the protection of human rights, but everybody who has some little information and understand the history would know that the aim is that the United States cannot accept and does not want to accept a government in this region that is not subject to the demands of corporate interests, whose government cannot be bought with money, where politicians respond to the people and not to who pays the most, where we can carry out social, health, educational, housing policies without having to ask the permission of the International Monetary Fund.
Carlos Fernandez de Cossio, Cuba's Deputy Foreign Minister, we thank you for being with us, speaking to us from New York. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7.
KBOO News is proud to present our 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, and we want to hear your thoughts as we approach the midterm election. What do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card as a thank you. Plus, it will help our volunteer reporters cover the election with the info that you need to know. Find the survey online at bit.ly/KBOO-survey. That's KBOO's 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, available online through September 25th at bit.ly/KBOO-survey.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, October 5th for Dead Moon Night,
a four-hour extravaganza
celebrating the 2017 event when 1,100 rockers showed up outside Portland City Hall
to commemorate the legendary band Dead Moon in an official city proclamation of October 5th as Dead Moon Night.
Again, that's Dead Moon Night, Wednesday, October 5th, from 8 p.m. till midnight.
Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, wildfires in the West are threatening more of the snowpack, and with it, our water supply. Our country is moving to protect its elections. And why this is a special week for Oregon's Crater Lake.
In Oregon, Crater Lake stands out as one of the most incredible properties. And in fact, the acreage of that park exceeds the sum of the acreage of all of our state parks.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 22, 2022. I am Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. The process by which Congress certifies our presidential elections is being overhauled. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
The United States House of Representatives has passed legislation overhauling the rules for certifying the results of a presidential election. This appears to be a response to the January 6th Capitol insurrection and ex-President Trump's failed attempt to remain in power. The House bill addresses an 1800s-era statute known as the Electoral Count Act, which helps govern how states and Congress certify electors and declare presidential election winners. That process used to be routine and ceremonial. However, Trump and his supporters unsuccessfully tried to exploit loopholes in the law in an attempt to overturn his defeat to Joe Biden in the 2020 election. Democrats wanted the bill to pass ahead of the 2024 election cycle, as Trump appears to be considering another run. The House vote fell mostly along party lines. The final tally was 229 to 203. With 9 Republicans joining all of the Democrats in voting for the bill. 8 of the 9 voted for Trump's impeachment immediately after the insurrection, and none of the 9 Republicans is returning to Congress next year. The House Republicans voting against argued that the legislation is not a priority and that it is being used as a political tool by Democrats preparing for November's midterm elections. The legislation was co-sponsored by Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney, Republican, and House Administration Committee Zoe Lofgren, Democrat, California. Both are members of the committee investigating the January 6th attack. It sets new parameters around the January joint session of Congress that happens every 4 years after a presidential election. The bill would clarify that the vice president's role presiding over the count is only ceremonial and that he or she cannot change the results. It also says each state can only send one certified set of electors. Trump's allies had previously tried to put together alternate slates of illegitimate pro-Trump electors in swing states carried by Biden. The legislation also increases the threshold for individual lawmakers' objections to any state's electoral votes, requiring a third of the House and a third of the Senate to object to trigger votes on the results. Currently, only one lawmaker in the House and one in the Senate has to object. Additionally, the House bill defines very narrow grounds for those objections, an attempt to thwart politically motivated or baseless challenges. Finally, the bill requires courts to get involved if state or local officials want to delay a presidential vote or refuse to certify the results. The United States Senate is putting forward a similar bill, with enough Republican support to virtually ensure passage before the end of the year. A Senate committee is expected to vote next week. Republicans voting against the bill also argued that voters are more focused on the economy and other issues than elections law. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, Democrat, Maryland, was blunt. He criticized Republicans who defended Trump's actions that day and who have downplayed the seriousness of the former president's attempts to overturn the results of the election. Hoyer called the Republican opposition a, quote, rationalization of what I believe is treason. It was rationalized then, and sadly, it is being rationalized now, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A judge has tossed out Washington County's ban on flavored tobacco. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has the details.
2021's ban on the sale of flavored tobacco products in Washington County was overturned by a judge this week, citing that Oregon state law preempts the ban. Circuit Judge Andrew Irwin ruled on the matter, saying the decision to ban such products must come from a state level, not county by county. Opinion was noted that the county had, quote, broad power to regulate how sales are made, but cannot bar their sales entirely. Washington County officials pushed for the ban last November, saying flavor-enhanced nicotine products, including flavors such as bubblegum and tropical fruit, were likely to create addiction in teenagers and young adults, where their purchases were often made without checking IDs. Senate Bill 587 was enacted in 2021, which enables public health agencies to regulate tobacco sales, prompted the ban that, though initially supported by voters, met strong pushback from retailers. This first Oregon enacted law went into effect last January, but was challenged by contesters who filed a suit against the ban in February, resulting in Irwin issuing a preliminary injunction against the ban in May. Cheers of support came from the retailers who brought the suit following Monday's decision, though Washington County officials will likely appeal the decision, arguing that Irwin misinterpreted SB 587 and the limits that local health authorities could enact based upon it. Tony Aiello, attorney for the retailers who brought the suit, cheered the decision but also said, quote, "The litigation is not over yet," end quote. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Public Lands Day will celebrate spectacular landmarks both in Oregon and across the country. They include Crater Lake National Park, which covers more than 180,000 acres in southern Oregon. This Saturday, people can visit national parks for free, including Crater Lake and four other Oregon properties managed by the National Park Service. Eric Tegedoff talks to the executive director of Oregon Parks Forever.
Saturday is National Public Lands Day, a celebration of national parks in the United States. People will be able to access national park lands for free in celebration of the day. Events such as cleanups and habitat improvement also are planned. Seth Miller is head of Oregon Parks Forever, a nonprofit dedicated to enhancing and preserving public lands in the state.
The National Park Service properties preserve some of the most spectacular lands across the country. In Oregon, Crater Lake stands out as one of the most incredible properties, and in fact, the acreage of that park exceeds the sum of the acreage of all of our state parks.
While Crater Lake is Oregon's only national park, Miller notes the National Park Service oversees four other locations in the state. They are the John Day Fossil Beds National Monument, Newberry National Volcanic Monument, Oregon Caves National Monument, and Lewis and Clark National Historical Park. Miller says warming temperatures are a concern for national parks.
All public lands across the United States are dealing with the effects of climate change, and particularly in the western states, we're facing a number of years of drought and increasing wildfires.
To help mitigate the wildfire risk, Miller says Oregon Parks Forever plans to plant 1 million trees. It planted more than 500,000 last year. Miller also notes that parks are dealing with large backlogs in deferred maintenance, although the Great American Outdoors Act passed by Congress in 2020 is helping to address this issue. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Researchers warn that as climate change increases wildfire areas and snow zones throughout the West, the wildfire influence on the snowpack will also grow. As Eric Galatis reports, a new study in the Journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences suggests this trend will disrupt our water supplies.
Wildfires in Wyoming and across the West are creating bigger impacts on snowpack that supplies farms, energy production, and drinking water for millions of downstream users, according to a new study. Report co-author Stephen Fosnacht says the 2020 Mullen Fire in southern Wyoming and Cameron Peak Fire in Colorado were both very large fires that destroyed forests in places that have historically not seen fires spark or spread.
They were burning at this high elevation where the snowpack is deep, and they burned up there not because of a lack of snow, they burned because of lack of rain in the summer.
Researchers found that snow in wildfire-burned locations is now melting roughly 3 weeks earlier than normal, and Fosnacht says as climate change expands fire zones into more snow areas, water managers and others may need to make adjustments. Increasing storage capacity can help capture melting snowpack, and managers can also retime water releases from reservoirs to be in sync with time-sensitive users, including farms. Instead of less than precise tools such as snow courses and snowtell stations to estimate annual water supplies, Fosnacht says managers will need to tap technologies including LIDAR, which works like radar using light instead of radio waves to measure snowpack, and new modeling that can better calculate actual water volumes.
We need to use multiple tools from our toolbox to better manage the water. One is the storage, and two is the information of how much is there and how much is actually coming into the system.
After the Cameron Peak fire, the city of Fort Collins was forced to cut off water coming down the mountain because it was filled with ash and soot. Wildfires can also increase landslides in watersheds, which Fosnacht says can harm fish habitat and water quality for downstream users.
especially municipalities, especially for residential water use, downstream of any of these fires. The ash is very difficult to treat in water treatment plants.
This is Eric Galatis reporting.
The nonprofit Save the Redwoods League is hoping to open kids' minds to issues about the watershed and old-growth forests. As Suzanne Potter reports, for some elementary students, a trip to the Redwood Forest is a game changer.
As California's kids settle into the new school year, about 1,500 students will soon take the field trip of a lifetime to see the giant redwoods. The nonprofit Save the Redwoods League works with schools from Santa Cruz up to Humboldt. Emily Weiberg teaches fourth graders at Achieve Academy in Oakland. She says the day trip to Reinhardt Redwood Regional Park is a game changer for kids from under-resourced communities.
For the majority of them, it's their first time being out in nature like that. So it's really exciting to see them just getting their hands dirty and exploring.
Weiberg's class also takes part in the watershed program at Crab Cove in partnership with the East Bay Regional Park District. There, the kids put on waders and examine the marine ecosystem. Trips for junior high and high school students focus more on scientific data collection. Deborah Zierton with Save the Redwoods League says the program promotes diversity, equity, and inclusion by creating opportunities in all communities.
We try and provide free bus transportation, or if they're able to provide buses, we always provide free instruction when we get to the forest. We don't want to charge because we don't want that to be a barrier.
The program hopes to inspire students to consider careers in forestry and natural resource management, and it teaches students about the threats to the watershed and old-growth forests, such as development, but also wildfire and drought linked to climate change. I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the BOO, the KBOO Citizens Agenda Survey, then Noise Filter. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Activist Radio. Tonight's weather, a few passing clouds, a low down to 49. Tomorrow's weather, morning clouds give way to sun, a high of 73. Today in history, on this date in 1862, President Lincoln issued a preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, setting a date for the freedom of more than 3 million enslaved people. The quote of the day is from Lincoln. It is an old maxim and a very sound one that he that dances should always pay the fiddler. You may not even know it, but just a couple days ago, our nation marked its Constitution Day. I talked to history professor Dr. Chris Nichols, who explains how and why that's important for our civil rights. It may not be, you know, on the level of Christmas or Hanukkah or all these other big holidays, but I think we should still care about Constitution Day.
I do too, yes. Okay. In fact, at Oregon State, I had the great pleasure of being the lead organizer for our annual Constitution Day on September 17th. Every year. This is the first year, 2022, that I haven't done it in probably 10 years.
So what kind of festivities would normally commence with said Constitution Day?
So we often did very serious panels and discussions and community sort of town hall events to think about exactly what I think you're implying by saying we should care about the Constitution. So things like, let's talk about individual rights and collective responsibilities, and let's dive into the 14th Amendment, or think about the First or Second Amendments. What do they really mean? How have they been interpreted? How have they changed over time? What are your rights? They sound basic, but they're actually some of the most profound questions in a democracy, and certainly in ours. And some of them seem much more embattled today than they did 5 or 10 years ago. So all the more reason to not just celebrate Constitution Day, but actually read the Constitution, critically think about it. I can't help but say I wish every person elected to Congress was forced to take a short class in constitutional history. I think we'd all be better off for that.
Right. There was a survey that was done by Brainly, which is an online digital homework help platform, where they found over 30% of the respondents believed that the U.S. Constitution and the Declaration of Independence are the same document. Hey. What does that tell you about what our education system's doing, what it needs to do?
Well, it's really disappointing, for one. You know, I will say, as a historian, the polls of this going back since we got modern polling in the 1930s have suggested that Americans know woefully little about the Constitution, the Declaration, and all these kinds of critically important elements of their own rights and the way that the U.S. government operates. You know, one thing that it tells me is that we're not doing a good enough job as educators linking these sorts of documents that seem old and musty to the actual lived experience of regular people. Maybe K-12, maybe college, but, you know, we should be getting this out there that people actually care about, think a little bit about, oh, you know, some of my rights come from this obscure amendment about not quartering soldiers in my house. That's important. You might not believe it, but, you know, were martial law declared next week, your constitutional rights would be part of your thinking about whether or not the National Guard could be in your house. You know, and we think about this with more inflammatory kinds of issues, some of the big sort of culture wars issues of today, like abortion rights. Is there a right to privacy? Should it have been construed as something other than a right to privacy? You know, this is the classic constitutional law question about those decisions. Those seem really important today, right? We're seeing battles in virtually every state and at the Supreme Court level on this. That also, though, suggests to me something else, which is interesting, that people seem to disaggregate out their belief in being pro-choice, pro-life, from the Constitution itself. They maybe don't know that the Declaration and the Constitution are different documents, but they have some view about a particular issue that actually is deeply rooted in constitutional rights and responsibilities.
How many of our members of Congress have actually read the Constitution, I wonder?
I do too. You know, it's one of the things that saddens me the most when you hear someone defending some part of the Constitution, and then you realize that they don't really even know which amendment they're talking about. This happened recently, and I won't name names unless you want me to.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's just very disappointing to me, because I would like to think, at least, even though everything in contemporary politics in some ways is colored through the lens of partisanship, that you have your facts straight, at least insofar as knowing which constitutional amendment you're calling on in a given time. I'd love to do a little explanation of Constitution Day itself, if you'd like.
Yes, please. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So one of the really interesting things about Constitution Day that got me interested in organizing events at Oregon State is that the federal government has mandated that all universities, all institutions of higher ed that get federal funds have to do something for Constitution Day. That day itself, September 17th, is recognized because in September 17th, 1787 in Philadelphia, the Constitution was signed by 39 people. Whose names we know well, founding fathers, founding framers, and that those and related actions are a significant measure of why we're here today. And so we're supposed to interrogate them. But the longer history of the Constitution Day and thinking about this kind of commemoration and what it's about is also really fascinating. So I did some research on this some years ago, and days honoring citizenship in the Constitution used to happen in lots of cities and even states back to the Progressive Era. So 1911, you can find some examples of this, or I have, and there seems to be some cities that were doing this in the 19th century, late 19th century as well. But it's not until the 20th century that you really find, in the context of world wars, that Americans start celebrating this and that Congress got invested in it. And that shouldn't surprise us, because those were moments, especially World War II, where they were trying to figure out how to congeal a diverse population into a lot of people who are hyper-patriotic supporting the war effort, right? So it's 1939, I think, that you actually get the first day celebrated through an act of Congress. Then after that, 1940, 41, it becomes instantiated in law as a particular day in May, and they called it an I Am an American Day, which now isn't exactly something that we would necessarily go for, wouldn't fit quite as well. And so as you go through time in the Eisenhower administration, they started to shift this around. It became Citizenship Day. That maybe isn't exactly what we'd go for now, but they were trying to make it more broad and inclusive. And then they made it a week, and then they went back to a day. And in any case, it's really in the 50s that you see a lot of this happening. And the short answer for that is the Cold War. Trying to educate Americans on the Constitution and on questions of citizenship and bring people together under the conditions of the Cold War to think about, you know, what their rights were, what their obligations to the state were. Remember selective service and the draft. At any moment, there could be a nuclear war. And so it's kind of a mid-20th century thing that we wound up with a Constitution Day, even though we're hearkening back to 1787.
Yeah. So happy Constitution Day. We definitely need to pay more attention to it in light of what's going on.
For sure. Yeah. And in fact, just to underscore that point, it's actually after 9/11 that the Congress passes the laws that give us what we have now. They renamed the holiday Constitution Day and Citizenship Day in about 2005.
This is a pretty recent phenomenon then.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The state of New York sues former President Donald Trump for fraud. President Biden condemns Russia's war in Ukraine at the United Nations. And the Federal Reserve again raises interest rates to fight inflation. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here is 2022 Talks.
I am announcing that today we are filing a lawsuit against Donald Trump for violating the law as part of his efforts to generate profits for himself, his family, and his company.
New York Attorney General Letitia James filed a civil lawsuit against former President Donald Trump and his family business Wednesday, alleging Trump, three of his adult children, and two longtime company executives fraudulently overvalued assets by billions of dollars. James said Trump and the other defendants used more than 200 false valuations on annual financial statements over 10 years. Speaking before the United Nations General Assembly, President Biden sharply condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine, saying the military offensive should make the world's blood run cold.
Permanent member of the United Nations Security Council invaded its neighbor, attempted to erase a sovereign state from the map.
Biden spoke just hours after Russian President Vladimir Putin warned he might use nuclear weapons if threatened and announced plans to call up 300,000 reservists to aid in his country's war effort. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell announced the third straight interest rate hike in an effort to control high inflation, now at a 40-year high.
We have got to get inflation behind us. I wish there were a painless way to do that. There isn't.
The central bank raised rates by 0.75 percentage point for a total of 3 full percentage points this year, despite concerns the rate hikes could increase unemployment or send the economy into a recession. The House Homeland Security Committee Wednesday held a hearing on America's aging infrastructure and the role environmental racism plays when allocating federal aid. Committee Chairman Benny Thompson of Jackson, Mississippi, said his city, which recently suffered a critical failure in its drinking water system, is not alone.
In fact, of the water systems that consistently violate federal drinking water standards, 40% of them serve communities of color.
Thompson said studies show black and brown communities are likely to bear the brunt of natural disasters. The House advanced a bill to overhaul the Electoral Count Act, which determines how state and Congress certify electors and declare the winner of presidential elections. New York Representative Hakeem Jeffries said democracy cannot run on autopilot.
Particularly because we are confronting a diabolical adversary who is determined to undermine the principle of free and fair elections.
Finally, the Senate ratified an international agreement to limit the use of hydrofluorocarbons, the toxic greenhouse gases used in refrigerators and air conditioning. Production and use of the gases will be phased down 85% over the next 14 years. For Public News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
Community housing groups say extreme weather events are among the reasons aging homes are running into repair backlogs. And for many homeowners, getting a home improvement loan is difficult. As Mike Moen reports, government help for older homes could offer one solution for the housing crisis.
As the housing market navigates a sea of obstacles, community-level organizations in Minnesota say government should take a closer look at their strategies for supporting older neighborhoods. They say deteriorating homes shouldn't be overlooked. Construction of new homes continues to lag, in part because of supply chain issues. But groups such as NeighborWorks Home Partners say there are plenty of neighborhoods in Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as surrounding suburbs, that have an aging stock. Chief Program Officer Beth Heiser says the scale of funds set aside for things like home improvement loans hasn't kept up with demand.
We're seeing more and more folks trying to age in their homes, but because of a variety of financial situations, have not been able to keep up with maintenance.
And she says there's a lot of first-time home buyers who can't afford to take on debt for necessary repairs. Community partners worry it will lead to more issues like gentrification, with private investors buying up properties. Heiser says state and local government should do all they can to access funds through the federal home program, noting it offers flexibility in buying or rehabbing affordable housing. Jim Urchell of St. Paul's Dayton's Bluff Neighborhood Housing Services says they too see a lot of older residents staying in homes with maintenance needs piling up. He says that prevents them from being able to sell. His group can facilitate options, but there are barriers.
The state has a good deferred loan program for extremely low-income folks, but it's rather burdensome to administer.
Urchell says a client and a community organization could spend a lot of time seeking approval, only to see it fall through. He suggests creating more efficiencies and expanding eligibility for that program, while still allowing for accountability, could go a long way in seeing their aging housing stock get the attention it needs. Both groups say full renovation costs have skyrocketed, and that smaller investments over time can prevent a collection of neighborhood homes needing major overhauls at once. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
Native stakeholders discuss repatriation plans. The Senate confirms a new IHS director, and Cherokee leaders push for a House delegate. For these stories more, here's today's edition of National Native News.
Native students, faculty, and staff at the University of Kansas gathered Wednesday to talk about plans for the handling of the remains of ancestors and cultural items. The university acknowledged this week it has possession of Native American remains and objects. Melissa Peterson, KU Director of Tribal Relations, is hopeful they'll return home.
I am pleasantly surprised that we, meaning our community and me and my office, are getting the support. I don't think that is usually typical in these situations. They came together really quick to talk about a statement and how we can be transparent to campus. And the urgency for Native people to know where these remains are, because that connection we have to them, you know, a lot of good, but also a lot of bad in some of our cultures. So it's been really nice. They actually are taking the time to understand, too, what it is we're feeling individually, and understanding that it's not the same for everyone, especially with our so many tribes and protocols that we have.
KU student Michael Redbear says it's a sensitive topic and needs to be handled in collaboration with the Native community.
You know, the more and more this goes on, the more sensitive the information becomes, because it's so heavy and it's been unintended for so long. And so more focused on kind of like the mental shock that a lot of people are going to have, and kind of figuring out a way where we can alleviate some of that that pressure. And I strongly believe like what we did this evening is one of those answers, is where we hold a circle together as a community, and we talk about how we're feeling, what kind of ideas we have, and sharing some food.
In the past, there were some repatriation efforts, but were never completed. The U.S. Senate has confirmed Rosalind So as director of the Indian Health Service. She was nominated by President Biden in March. The nomination